Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Chandra Balani to review recent developments in the field, and he began our conversation by commenting on a major shift in the last couple of years in the management of metastatic non-small cell, specifically adenocarcinoma, prompted by his report 2 years ago and others that followed evaluating the role of maintenance treatment after induction chemotherapy with or without bevacizumab.
So I think maintenance therapy in advanced non-small cell lung cancer is a new treatment paradigm. And I think that there is still some skepticism against maintenance therapy regarding its role. But let's go ahead and clarify this. We presented the trial of maintenance pemetrexed versus placebo after 4 cycles of platinum-based chemotherapy. And that showed a significant improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival. And when we look at the pre-planned subset analysis of the non-squamous cell subset, there was a provocative 5.2-month improvement in median survival, and the hazard ratios were phenomenal. Now, this was intent-to-treat analysis, and there was significant improvement in survival in the whole group. But the skepticism which has been raised is that all patients on the placebo arm were not crossed over to pemetrexed at the time of progression. So that has been one of the issues which has been raised.
Well, also, I guess not everybody actually received second-line therapy.
No, 2/3 of the patients ended up getting second-line therapy. And that's the real world, that only 2/3 of the patients are able to make it to second-line intervention. And 1/3 actually disappeared. So that means they have progressed or they have died, despite adequate follow-up on a clinical trial. And some investigators say that we can follow these patients and give them early maintenance. But how could you give early maintenance if you could not follow those patients on a planned clinical trial where the PFS was the endpoint? So I think that it argues against it. Now, I would say also that patients who have a poor performance status, when they finish their maintenance or when they finish their induction chemotherapy, then they should not be treated with maintenance. They should be given a break. But those patients who are responding and have good performance status, they are the ones who are really benefiting. The second issue which has been raised is whether it is those patients who have stable disease or those who have responsive disease. So stable disease patients, of course, are going to do much better as compared to partial response because the partial response is only seen in a few patients. So it's less than 10% anyway with single agent pemetrexed. So most of these patients in the maintenance setting have stable disease. And this was shown in the Saturn study, where erlotinib has also shown an improvement in median survival and has been approved by the FDA for its use. But its use is not that significant in the maintenance setting because the numbers as compared to the pemetrexed trial were lower. And there was a provocative improvement in survival with the hazard ratio in progression-free survival, where the hazard ratio was 0.1 in patients who had presence of EGFR mutation. So patients who have EGFR mutation should get maintenance or erlotinib, and patients who have non-squamous cell disease are candidates for pemetrexed. Patients who have poor performance status should not receive maintenance therapy and should be followed. And there is a significant improvement in survival.
What about the issue of the patient with a non-squamous tumor who's receiving pemetrexed as part of the upfront regimen? There are a lot of people now who use carbo, PEM, and BEV. What about maintenance for those patients?
So it is being done in practice that pemetrexed is being continued and the platinum is stopped. It is the uptake of that is close to about 30% as of yet. And the reason is that we are awaiting the data from the Paramount trial, as I said to you earlier, that cisplatin pemetrexed upfront, which we did not do in our pemetrexed maintenance study, followed by pemetrexed versus placebo. So that is the trial which will be presented at ASCO this year.
Any comments about the so-called point break study?
The point break study is very interesting that it is looking at the combination of carboplatin pemetrexed and bevacizumab, followed by bevacizumab and pemetrexed. That regimen is being compared to the ECOG 4599 investigational arm, which led to the approval of bevacizumab.
So that's carbo-paclitaxel BEV.
Followed by BEV maintenance. So I think that the study actually is slightly offbeat in the sense that it is asking two different questions because there are two variances here, that up front there is an agent which is different, but in the maintenance setting also there is one agent versus two agents. So a clean trial which is asking the question of the combination pemetrexed and bevacizumab is ECOG 5508, in which all patients received carboplatin, bevacizumab, and paclitaxel up front in bevacizumab-eligible patients. And then the stable and responding patients are being randomized to single-agent bevacizumab, as was done in ECOG 4599, single-agent pemetrexed, as we showed in our study, and the combination of pemetrexed and bevacizumab.
How long has that study been going on?
The study just recently started 3 months ago. There are a couple dozen patients on the trial.
Any predictions?
Predictions is a good word. It will be very difficult for me to predict because it is my trial and I am the co-PI of the study. I think the study needs to be done and it is a good question and it needs to be asked. And I think the regimens are well tolerated.
Seems like it's going to take a sizable number of patients to ask that question.
So the number of patients to enter on the trial is over 1,200, and 863 patients will be randomized to the three arms of the study.
Very ambitious and very important. So let me just ask you the question that I'm sure a lot of docs in practice ask you, which is outside a protocol setting right now, what do you tend to do? What's your plan, including maintenance, in the patient who's presenting with metastatic adenocarcinoma, let's assume EGFR and EML4 ALK negative?
So what we are doing is that, as I'm a member of ECOG, we follow the ECOG regimen of carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, if you have to give bevacizumab, and then maintain them on bevacizumab, as we did in ECOG 4599. And the alternate to that is to give carboplatin and pemetrexed, which I usually give without bevacizumab, and then maintain them on single-agent pemetrexed as maintenance therapy. So in the real world in North America, this is what we do because we substitute carboplatin for cisplatin as the age-old controversy continues.
What about in patients presenting with metastatic squamous cell?
So in metastatic squamous cell, our regimens are carboplatin paclitaxel or carboplatin docetaxel. The carboplatin gemcitabine regimen is there, but I have not really favored it because of the problem with thrombocytopenia. I usually prefer to leave gemcitabine out of the frontline regimens.
Before we get off this onto new agents, what about the issue of actual histologic diagnosis? How often are you concerned in terms of not being sure whether it's a non-squamous or not?
So in the past, what we used to see, Neil, is that we used to have approximately 20 to 25% of the patients where we did not get the real histology. And as we are actually pushing our pathologists to give us a histological diagnosis, as the regimens approved are based on histology or approved based on toxicity related to the regimens and various subhistologies of non-small cell lung cancer, we are requesting that we get that based on either just plain histology or immunohistochemical markers. And so far, actually, we have been able to increase that number of patients who have specific histologies to over 90 to 95%. So it's only now 5 to 10% of the patients who we don't have that histology. And then we ask for various other markers if they're available. And if we have a predominance of one histology in that subset, we usually want to treat them with these specific regimens, such as the bevacizumab-containing regimens or the pemetrexed-containing regimens, which are approved in these subsets.
How often do you find yourself concluding that a patient has a mixed adenosquamous? And if so, what do you do?
Well, what we are seeing is that it is probably in less than 5% of the patients we get adenosquamous histology. And if it is predominantly adenocarcinoma, we still continue to treat them as if they are adenocarcinoma because not a lot of advances have occurred in patients with squamous cell carcinoma. And we continue to use that plain Jane platinum-based regimens for squamous cell cancer. And we really do not have significant maintenance therapy advances also in squamous cell carcinoma, though erlotinib is approved. But in my practice, actually, I have rarely seen a response in squamous cell carcinoma with erlotinib.
So I'm going to ask you about a couple papers that you published that I highly recommend to any oncologist to read. And maybe if you could just talk a little bit about some of your thinking there. The first is a paper you had in Cancer Investigation the role of irreversible EGFR inhibitors in the treatment of non-small cell. Can you kind of talk about what you were thinking about in this paper and what about it is stuff that oncologists in practice really need to know about?
Well, we now know that patients who have presence of EGFR mutation in exon 19 and 21 are candidates for first-line therapy with EGFR inhibitors, either gefitinib or erlotinib, depending on where the patient is located. As gefitinib is not approved and not available for use in the Western world, especially in North America, and it is available in Europe and the Far East. So based on the IPASS study and based on two other clinical trials, the Spanish study and also the Japanese study, and now actually you will hear on the Chinese study of gefitinib in the frontline setting as compared to carboplatin and gemcitabine, that there is a role of first-line EGFR TKI inhibitors in patients who have presence of EGFR mutation. But there is one caveat that those who do not have presence of EGFR mutation should not receive EGFR TKIs. That was one conclusion made on all these three clinical trials.
Should not receive it at all or not receive it up front?
I don't think they should receive it at all, because though we have not really deciphered this in the second line setting because the BR21 trial was positive in all comers, but I still think that the benefit is in a select group of patients. So this is just my thought process. And once these patients are on EGFR inhibitors, they eventually do progress. And whether it is the occurrence or presence of c-MET overexpression or mutation or abnormality or development of T790 mutations, which may actually be present even at the outset, that these patients actually stop responding to EGFR inhibitors. So there is one controversy that if they have presence of EGFR mutation, should the EGFR TKI be continued in these patients and a new drug be added? Or should they be switched to these irreversible inhibitors of EGFR as they are still addicted to that mutation?
And of course, you're looking over the fence at breast cancer, where there was a raging controversy about this in terms of trastuzumab.
Right.
That finally got resolved with anti-HER therapy for life.
That's correct. So I think that that question is still unresolved. And I think that we will hear about it at ASCO. There is a mutation consortium who are going to present that data, which we don't know yet. There is a lung cancer mutation consortium which has been formed, and they will show us that data at ASCO this year.
Just out of curiosity, at least at this point, do you sort of subscribe to the concept or not?
No, I really do not continue at the present point in time until the data becomes available. But we either switch them to irreversible EGFR inhibitors or pan-HER inhibitors such as BIBW2992, or use RQL197, which is the c-MET inhibitor, in addition to erlotinib. That is being done on the clinical trial where it has shown a benefit, especially in those patients who have KRAS mutations. So I think that we are headed towards the direction of either irreversible EGFR inhibitors, either in addition to the EGFR TKIs or by themselves. So there are a couple other drugs, multiple others, which are in clinical trials.
Can you expand a little bit more on some of these other pathways and agents? You know, oncologists have heard about BIBW2992 and breast cancer as well.
BIBW2992, which is both a HER1 and HER2 or EGFR inhibitor, actually is probably an agent. And the hint of activity has been seen in the phase 3 clinical trial where it was given in patients who had received at least 12 weeks of an EGFR TKI and then progressed, and in that subgroup of patients, when it was compared to placebo, there was a provocative and significant improvement in progression-free survival as presented at ESMO last year, but there was no improvement in survival. But I think that we should take this into consideration, that these are patients who are actually at the nth line of treatment. And though they have initially received EGFR TKI, they actually are on the treatment without that progression for a prolonged duration of time. But there is no improvement in survival because the patients on the placebo arm cross over to other therapies after just 3 to 6 weeks. So I think that the agent is really active. And the ongoing clinical trials will probably show the efficacy of the agent. So the ongoing clinical trials are specifically in patients who have EGFR mutation, and it is being compared to combination chemotherapy in the frontline setting. So that is probably a good way to study those agents.
So these irreversible agents like this one, BIBW2992, do they actually bind the same way erlotinib and gefitinib do? It's just they're irreversible, or they bind differently?
Well, they bind slightly differently and also in the same way, but it is irreversible inhibition, and they also bind to the other EGFR that's the HER2 new. So they also bind to EGFR2 and EGFR1. So I think that we will see that there is increased activity. And the Pfizer compound, actually, which doesn't have a name, actually binds to HER1, HER2, HER3, and HER4. So that's also a pan HER inhibitor, and that has been studied in combination with erlotinib.
What about the side effects tolerability profile of these irreversible inhibitors, both qualitatively, are they kind of similar to the other ones, and quantitatively?
I think qualitatively it is about the same. That is rash and diarrhea as the primary side effects with these EGFR inhibitors. And I think quantitatively there was slightly increased diarrhea with a couple of these compounds, but especially the Pfizer compound, but the BIBW2992 was actually fairly well tolerated in comparison. But there is a slight increase in diarrhea with some of these agents, and we need to be careful when we combine it, especially with the EGFR TKIs.
Any thoughts about when these agents might be at a point where we'll have clinical trial data to determine whether or not they should come into practice?
I think, Neil, the phase 3 trials have just been initiated. So the trials have actually, though the first-line trials are almost completing accrual, it will be still another couple of years before that data becomes available.
You also mentioned ARC-197 and c-MET. What about the c-MET pathway, and what about these agents that interfere with it?
So the c-MET actually is the pathway in the ALK and downstream of EGFR. And c-MET mutations are rare. So we do not see c-MET mutations. Occasionally, you can see a c-MET mutation. So the overexpression of c-MET has been shown to have a prognostic effect, not only in lung cancer, but also in other malignancies such as hepatocellular carcinoma and head and neck cancer. So we have a model of the c-MET overexpressing hepatocellular carcinoma cell lines at our institution. And what has been shown is that if you give them a c-MET inhibitor, they actually respond. And prognostically, they are the worst subgroup, and they become the best subgroup when they get the c-MET inhibitor. This is all preclinical work and needs to be validated in the clinic. So what has been shown is that c-MET expression could be secondary after treatment, or it could be inherent. So if the mutation was present, then it is present in the tumor up front rather than a secondary occurrence. But expression can occur later on, and that's why the tumor becomes resistant. So addition of a c-MET inhibitor in that subgroup, especially in those patients who have EGFR TKI, it only makes sense to actually continue the erlotinib and gefitinib and add the c-MET inhibitor. And that's the premise of all the clinical trials that are being done. The second pathway is the survival pathway of PI3 kinase and P10 mutation. So the P10 mutations, and then if you go downstream to look at MAP kinase and interaction with the EGFR pathway, there is a crosstalk. So I think that we will see a lot more data where the PI3 kinase inhibitors and mTOR inhibitors may have a role in patients who have refractory disease to the EGFR TKIs. And that also requires further investigation. The PI3 kinase inhibitors at this point in time are in phase 1 and 2 trials, and the activity is primarily in patients who have P10 mutations. So I think as we move forward, we will need to have a better understanding of especially adenocarcinoma or the non-squamous cell subset, because most of these abnormalities occur in those subsets. And number of agents are being studied in that setting also.
Definitely hearing a lot about PI3 kinase, but getting back to c-MET, what's the nature of the agents that block it? Are they small molecules? Are they TKIs? What's ARC-197, for example?
So ARC-197 is a small molecule, and it is orally given, and it is, again, a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And the other aspect, the MET-MAB monoclonal antibody is also actually shown a benefit in c-MET expressors. So that subset of patients, and I think we'll hear an update on that study also at ASCO, where erlotinib was combined with MetMab and compared to Tarceva alone. And though the overall study did not show a benefit, but there is a subset of high MET expressors who showed a significant benefit. So that requires confirmation, and there is a phase 3 trial which is ongoing at the present point in time.
But is there an external receptor for c-MET?
Well, it is the ligand binding portion of the receptor. So yes, it binds the ligand rather than, then the receptor gets internalized, and once it gets internalized, it behaves like the tyrosine kinase portion.
Getting back to ARC-197, does it have TKI-like side effects?
Actually, the drug does have side effects, but they were very minimal.
Getting back to chemotherapy, what about nab-paclitaxel?
Nab-paclitaxel is not yet approved based on the response data. We are awaiting the PFS and the survival data from the nab-paclitaxel study, where the weekly nab-paclitaxel and carboplatin were compared with the combination of standard carboplatin and paclitaxel. Though the study met its primary endpoint of response rate, I think that we really need the PFS and OS on that clinical trial. And again, if the efficacy is primarily in the squamous cell subset, as was shown, where there is probably expression of SPARC based on albumin binding and entry into the cell, that may be the effect. And if it is a small subset of patients, especially the squamous cell carcinoma, then I think it will be a significant advance.
And I've heard people, specifically John Heymach, also talk about calveolin as a, you know, maybe increased with squamous cell. Any other thoughts in terms of NAB? Do you think there's any clinical, breast cancer, people talk about shorter infusion time, the lack of need for steroids. How do you think that plays out in lung cancer?
I think it decreases the chair time, meaning the hypersensitivity reactions. But we still continue to see some neuropathy. And if it decreases the neuropathy with the weekly regimen, I think that it will be used. We were not able to get the weekly paclitaxel regimen approved in combination with carboplatin in lung cancer, as it has taken off in breast cancer. As you remember, I had done all those studies, phase 3 trials, where we had compared the weekly paclitaxel regimen. And it's still called the Balani regimen. It is used everywhere in lung cancer, but it has not really taken off. And the recent study, which was presented at the plenary session at ASCO last year, where the weekly paclitaxel and carboplatin showed an impressive activity in the elderly subset of patients against single agents, I think that that is probably an active regimen, and weekly nab-paclitaxel would also, on the same lines, would be similar. Now, caveolin also has been implicated in the activity related to nab-paclitaxel, but we do not have any prospective data from these phase 3 clinical trials with both SPARC and caveolin from the trials that have been completed.
What about immune-based treatment? I've been hearing about the BLP25 vaccine.
So the Stimuvax vaccine was studied in combination with carboplatin-containing regimens with radiation. And it was shown that if you break those subsets of stage 3B versus 3 and 4, the primary activity was in stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer. So actually, that study has not been reported, the phase 3 clinical trial. I haven't seen the results of that data. I don't know whether you are aware of those phase 3 clinical trial. And ECOG is looking at it in combination with bevacizumab.
In combination with bevacizumab,
yes.
Interesting.
So we have a Stimuvax with bevacizumab. Dr. Patel is the PI of the clinical trial, and that just opened. Dr. Wagner is the radiation PI of that study. And it has been given with bevacizumab in the maintenance setting after they have received Stimuvax with carboplatin and radiation up front.
So speaking of Bev, another paper I wanted, a fabulous paper, really, Doc should read, that you and Dr. Ramalingam did, Angiogenic Agents in the Treatment of Non-Small Cell, Reality and Hope, Current Opinions in Oncology. Where are we today with anti-angiogenic therapy with lung cancer?
So the only agent that is approved is bevacizumab in combination with carboplatin and paclitaxel in North America. And the second clinical trial was cisplatin gemcitabine with and without bevacizumab. The trial, which was done primarily in Europe, did meet its primary endpoint of improvement in progression-free survival, but it was modest at best. And there was no improvement in survival in that study as compared to ECOG 4599, where we saw not only an improvement in PFS, but also improvement in overall survival. So bevacizumab is used, and there are various numbers which are thrown out by various pharmaceutical industries. I think that about 30 to 40% of BEV-eligible patients at this point in time are treated with bevacizumab. And the uptake of these anti-angiogenic agents in the European and Far Eastern world is still very, very small, and only occasional patients are treated with these therapies.
What do you think the reason is that most people who are, quote, BEV-eligible, I mean, at least in the United States, in patients who have access to this, what do you think the main reason is it's not being used?
Well, one, they try to find a reason for not using it. If the patient has mild hypertension, thromboembolism, or a patient has some squamous cell elements in their disease, or there is history of some small amount of bleeding, they try to shy away from that. And the second issue which has come up is that if you use another regimen in combination with bevacizumab, some of the third-party payers actually deny that payment. So the investigator or the community physician is actually not really wanting to take that risk in this day and age. So when pemetrexed-containing regimens became useful and approved in patients with non-squamous cell lung cancer, more commonly than not, they use the combination of carboplatin and pemetrexed or cisplatin and pemetrexed, where you saw also an improvement in survival as compared to the overall subgroup. So if you compare that, though, in the adenocarcinoma and large cell subset with cisplatin and pemetrexed, the median survival in the JMDB study, which was Giorgio Scagliati's trial published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, was 11.8 months. And if you just look at the all non-squamous cell subset, it was 11.1 months. So people say that if you extrapolate, though we should not do that, and compare it to ECOG 4599, the pemetrexed regimens have taken off. And if it is not paid for, they usually give carboplatin and pemetrexed. And now with maintenance pemetrexed coming as a new treatment paradigm, the median survivals of that subgroup have gone up to as high as 15.3 months. So that may be partially the reason that there is still use of these platinum-containing regimens specific for that subgroup of patients who are BEV-eligible and not give bevacizumab.
You mentioned the presence of hypertension. I was actually thinking about the ARI study, the registry kind of study that Tom Lynch reported, looking at how BEV was used in practice. But how much hypertension, particularly if it's treated successfully prior to deciding on BEV, will you use BEV in a patient who has controlled hypertension?
Yeah, we use it. In the patients that I've used, I do not see that as a significant problem. We have had a couple of patients who have been on prolonged bevacizumab who develop proteinuria and some kidney dysfunction, and then we have to stop it. But until they develop grade 3 proteinuria and we don't go and measure it, we continue the bevacizumab. And we have seen actually patients on bevacizumab for a year, 2 years and more. So I think that the drug is effective. We still do not know how the tumor actually takes off once you stop the drug. And I've also seen that there may be a Herceptin-like phenomenon, because if the effect is primarily on the endothelial cell and the vessel, then that drug also should be continued in the second-line setting. If the patients come off, say, carboplatin paclitaxel, if they're getting it with bevacizumab, and then they go on to pemetrexed with bevacizumab, then I think it should be continued. That hasn't been proven yet, though the colon cancer study in the same line was negative, and the NCI and others did not want us to do a second-line trial with bevacizumab in that setting. But actually, we are close to completing at least a phase 2 randomized study in that setting, which we will report probably next year.
Yeah, there's been obviously huge debate about this in colon cancer. Getting back to the issue of whether to use BEV, one of the things that I see maybe a little bit of question about in the community is the issue of tumor location. Initially, people were talking about proximal tumors, maybe more propensity to bleed. I'm not sure how often people don't get treated because of location. What are your thoughts about it?
I think location probably does not matter. It is the histology which probably has an implication rather than the location. I think we will continue to go round and round about that location. But I have really, in the clinical practice, not seen any significant bleeding, even treating those central tumors.
Any thoughts about trials, including the ECOG one, looking at bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting? Any thoughts about that today, particularly now that we've seen two negative colon trials?
Well, that is a very good question. The only trial which is ongoing is ECOG 1505, which is comparing standard chemotherapy combinations to the same chemotherapy with bevacizumab. And I think that trial will answer the question, but with small differences, and it looks like bevacizumab has an effect, we need to actually decipher a group where the effect is maximal. Because we do not have a biomarker for bevacizumab, though we say it is a targeted agent. And actually, it's not a targeted agent. It's just like empiric therapy at this point in time, but the primary effect not on the tumor, but on the vessels and VEGF. And if we continue to decipher other pathways such as angiopoietin 1 or angiopoietin 2 or the TIE1, so I think that there may be something which is escaping when we give just bevacizumab. We may need something in addition, but we need to be aware of the toxicities, as most of these agents which are now in clinical trials actually have the similar toxicity as the VEGFR inhibitors. So we need to come up with a biomarker for use of these anti-angiogenic agents.
Speaking of anti-angiogenic agents, I'm curious, there's a major ECOG adjuvant trial looking at chemo alone or with bevacizumab, and the study allows participants to choose from four different chemo regimens to combine with the Bev. Which one do you use?
So the four regimens are cisgemcitabine, cisnavalbine, cispemetrixed, and cisdozitaxel. So in patients off study, I use cisdozitaxel. Though the data around the world, and we sit with the European colleagues, they only give cisplatin and navalbine based on the meta-analysis, that is the regimen which has been studied in most of these adjuvant therapy trials. But in the US, we extrapolate the data from metastatic disease studies, ECOG 1594, and say all regimens are equivalent. They would be equivalent in adjuvant therapy also. So if you're a purist, you would give cisnavalbine, which we don't use in the United States, and I don't use it. So off study, in a patient who's got squamous cell carcinoma and needs adjuvant therapy, I give them cisdozitaxel. It's easy. It is one day, one shot, and they get their cisplatin docetaxel and they're out. And they come 3 weeks later, they're able to tolerate those four cycles of chemotherapy. There is no problem. In a patient with non-squamous cell carcinoma outside of a study, I give them cispemetrixed. If they have any problem with their renal function, then I give them carboplatin pemetrixed. That's outside of the study. So on the study also, if I have a squamous cell patient, he gets cisdozitaxel. I don't know, if he has non-squamous, he gets cispemetrixed.